Moshe Rabbeinu is told in no uncertain terms that the Ribbono Shel Olam's intention is to redeem the Jewish people and to take them to Eretz Yisrael and to free them from the bonds of Shibud Mitzrayim. And yet he's instructed to tell Paro that they want to go Derech Shloshes Yomim Bamidbar V'Nizbachol Hashem Elokeinu. We want to go for a 3-day journey in the desert and sacrifice to God. And that is what Moshe Rabbeinu negotiates with Paro throughout, till the very end. And the obvious question is, what's going on? Why did the Ribbono Shel Olam tell Moshe Rabbeinu to lie to Paro and to tell him they only want to go out for 3 days? So there are various answers to this. I'm going to give you first some of the answers that the Mefarshim say, and then I'll tell you what I think. The Ramban says that this was a strategy that the Ribbono Shel Olam used to get Paro to chase after the Jewish people when he found out that he had been tricked. That since he thought they were only going away for 3 days, and after 3 days he sees they are not intending to come back, so Paro felt duped. So that gave him the strength of heart to chase after them even after Makas Bechoros. Otherwise he wouldn't have had the stamina to chase after them. And what was the purpose of chasing after them? So that they could be drowned in the Yamsuf and get punished, Mida Keneged Mida, punished in kind. They drowned our children, they got drowned. And that's what impressed Yisro in the end, that God punished the Mitzri in the exact same way that they punished us. They drowned our children, they got drowned in the end. So in order to achieve that, the Ribbono Shel Olam made up this whole ploy for a strategy to set Paro up to chase after the Jewish people and to drown him in the Yamsuf. Okay, that's very nice, but God has no other ways to achieve what he wants to except by lying? Except by lying to Paro? He couldn't drown him by bringing the Yamsuf to him? God could have accomplished that. We have to bring Paro to the Yamsuf, bring the Yamsuf to him. Drown him in the Nile. That would be more Mida Keneged Mida. God hardened Paro's heart throughout the Makkos. Why couldn't he harden Paro's heart and make him come run after him? Why'd have to lie to him and dupe him? So we'll add to that another Perush, which basically complements and supplements what the Ramban says. That's the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh says that in order to punish Paro in kind, it wasn't enough only to drown him in the end. Because part of the way that Paro oppressed the Jewish people was not just with the physical oppression, which ultimately was drowning the children, which was the ultimate, but the way that he got to oppress us was through guile. Right? Perach, with a soft-spoken trickery. The Midrashim say that Paro announced that they have to build store cities for Mitzrayim, and every red-blooded, patriotic Egyptian should show up. So who showed up? The Jews. Right? Goyim, what do you have to go build store cities for Paro? But the Jews, they're more patriots than the Goyim of the countries that they live in. So they came, and originally Paro said, you will be paid an hourly wage for helping us build these important store cities. And gradually, they stop paying. And then one day the Jews look and they see that there are officers behind them telling them what kind of quota to do and that they can't leave when they decide to leave. And eventually they became enslaved. So it all was a process of trickery. So aside from the mental, physical anguish, there also was a aspect of feeling duped. And that is a terrible, terrible tsar. It's in itself a suffering to feel that you've been made a fool of, that you've been had. That in itself is a suffering. So in order for Paro to be punished in kind, it wasn't enough just to drown him. He had to also be fooled. And that was part of the punishment. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam got him to go to the Yamsuf and be drowned. in a way that he was tricked and felt tricked in the end, in order that that should be part of the punishment. It wasn't just that this is a strategy that God thought up to get him to the Yamsuf. God could have thought of other strategies without lying. But this was part of the punishment itself. In order to punish him in kind, it had to be through guile and deception, just like he enslaved us through guile and deception. One answer. Second answer. And that is, there is an argument, what it means that God hardened Paro's heart. The Rambam learns that that means that God took away Paro's free choice. Paro, the first five makos, on his own hardened his heart. And at that point, God said already he's reached the red line, there's no return. I'm taking away his ability to do tshuva. Tshuva is a chesed, doesn't have to be. God gives us a tremendous kindness in giving us the opportunity to rectify the things that we do wrong and to erase them. But sometimes, the Rambam says, a person sins so much that his ability to do tshuva is taken away from him. That's part of the punishment. And I don't know why that's such a philosophical point. It's a very simple point. Because sometimes the punishment a person gets is that he dies. Once he's dead, he can't do tshuva anymore. So for all practical purposes, if God decrees on a person death, he takes away his ability to do tshuva. So then why can't God not kill somebody and take away his ability to do tshuva? So that doesn't seem to me such a big philosophical point. So sometimes God says, I'm not going to kill this guy. I could have. And he deserves to die. And he deserves not to be able to do tshuva. But I want to make him a pawn for other people to learn from. So God left Paro alive and made him a pawn that through him other people will learn that there's a God in the world, that there's reward and punishment, and the Jewish people are special, and all the other things that were learned from the 10 plagues. So therefore, the Rabbanu Shem took Paro's free choice away. That's the Rambam Shita, and others. There's another Shita, though, in the Rishonim, and that is that God didn't take away Paro's free choice, just the opposite. By hardening his heart, he enabled him to have free choice. Because any normal person beset with the makos that Paro was beset with would have no free choice. He'd have to let them go. He'd be forced by the strength of the miracles that he's seen. So therefore, the Rabbanu Shem hardened his heart to balance out the makos with a hardened heart, and now he has free choice. Now he can choose to let them go or not to choose to let them go. He's not going to be forced by the strength of the makos. So the hardening of his heart didn't take away his free choice, but rather enabled him to have free choice. That's the other opinion. Now, according to that opinion, we can learn why God came to Paro with 3 days. God wanted Paro to have free choice. He wanted him to make a free choice of deciding to let them go. Not to be forced to let them go, not to be enabled not to let them go, free choice. God knew that if he came to Paro and said, let all your slaves go for good, that was an offer that Paro could not accept. It was beyond the free choice of Paro, and God wanted Paro to have free choice according to this opinion. Therefore, he started with him with something small. Let him go for 3 days, and mitzvah goreres mitzvah. If you agree to God's demand for the small thing, one mitzvah leads to another, and it becomes easier to do the next one, and then we'll negotiate about a month and 2 months and maybe a year, and maybe, you know, like a sabbatical in Israel for a while, and finally the Rabbanu Shel Olam would negotiate with Paro to let them go for good. So in order to enable Paro to exercise his free choice, the Rabbanu Shel Olam came to him with a smaller demand in hopes that he'd be able to agree, and if he could agree to that, then one mitzvah would lead to another, be easier for him to agree to the next stage and the next stage or whatever. Because Paro didn't agree even to that, so the Rabbanu Shel Olam took matters in his own hand and took us out of Mitzrayim. That's a second idea, a third idea. This is from, I think, the Yaros Devash from Rabbi Yonason Apeshitz, and it is enhanced by Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rabbi Yonason Apeshitz says the following, that really God only wanted to take the Jewish people out for 3 days in the desert. Why? Because really they were supposed to be in Mitzrayim for 400 years. That was the time that was prophesied to Avraham Avinu. And they only were in Mitzrayim 210 years. And had they remained the other 190 years, then their entire Golus would have been finished then. They would never have to go to Golus again. But because we left early, because if we would have stayed there another 190 years, we would have disappeared as a people. We would have totally assimilated. So God knew that's either now or never. So he was forced, because of our free choice, bad free choice, to take us out earlier. But because of that, there was 190 years that had to be made up, and it was been made up throughout Jewish history. And you'll ask, well, there's plenty, a lot more than 190 years of bad, but that was the root. In the root, what's one cell comes out as millions of cells in the plant. And therefore, every second in Mitzrayim corresponded maybe to a week, to a month, to a year. So 190 years translates into thousands of years of Golus, right? Because of the intensity of what Golus Mitzrayim was. So in any case, so we're suffering because they left early. But it was necessary because based on where they were holding, had God waited for the other 190 years, we never would have gone out. However, there was another possibility. And that possibility was the following. That instead of going out early, if Paro would agree that we should go out for a Shabbos, 3 days in the desert, and make sacrifices, it would be like a Shabbaton of Chizuk. And then the people were on a level, and the people who were running the Shabbaton were on a level, like Moshe and Aaron, right, and so on, that the Chizuk they could give in one Shabbos, one 3-day stint outside of Mitzrayim would be of such a nature that it would give them the ability to go back for another 190 years and finish off the 190 years. So really, the Rabban Shom did not want more than to let them go out for 3 days if Paro would agree. But ultimately, the Rabban Shom knew that Paro wasn't agree, so eventually he's going to take them out and going to go to Eretz Yisrael, and they're going to have to leave 190 years early. But ideally, giving Paro the option, because God doesn't take away free choice unless it's absolutely necessary, he gave Paro the option. If you'll agree to let them go, they're only going to go for 3 days in the desert and sacrifice to God. Unfortunately, Paro didn't agree. Or fortunately, he didn't agree. And therefore, God put into practice Plan B. Plan B is we leave now for good, and we'll worry about the 190 years over Jewish history. Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, or I think maybe even the Aristovash says this, same thing happened again by the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. We went into Babel for 70 years, came back to Eretz Yisrael. The majority of the Jewish people didn't come back. They stayed in Babel. Not only majority of the Jewish people, but the elite, the major Talmidei Chachamim, Amoraim, stayed in Babel. So there are many different explanations, some positive, some negative, of why they stayed in Babel. But this opinion says the following. Really, the Golus was supposed to be till Mashiach comes. We weren't supposed to go back to Eretz Israel after Golus Babel. It was supposed to be one long Golus from the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. There shouldn't have been a second Beis HaMikdash. We shouldn't have gone back to Eretz Israel in between. However, after 70 years in Babel, the people fell so intensely that they forgot the Aleph Beis. And if you think that's impossible, we have a counterpart. 70 years of communist oppression, there were people who had no idea what anything Jewish was. 70 years. They were totally cut off from the Jewish people, totally cut off from Jewish tradition, right? Constantly brainwashed. And they forgot Bichlal what Judaism was. So it's possible, 70 years, to totally forget everything. And God saw that if he leaves us in Golus like that, there's not going to be anybody to redeem when Mashiach comes. Because we chose to assimilate into and to forget Judaism completely. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam made a pekida. This is not the Geula. This is like a Shabbaton, except now we're not talking about people in the caliber of Mitzrayim. It's a lesser caliber. So we needed a long Shabbaton for 420 years. We went back to Eretz Yisrael, built a semblance of a Beis HaMikdash, which was missing some of the minor things that a Beis HaMikdash is supposed to have, like the Aron, the Luchos, the Shechina, the, what's it called, Urim V'Tumim, right? The fire on the Mizbeach. Some minor things, right? Like a shul without a Torah, without an Aron Kodesh, well, right? But it was a nice building. And it had some semblance of Shechina, and we could make korbanos. And the Jews were back in Eretz Yisrael in order to give us a boost that when we left after the 420 years, we'd be able to survive till Mashiach comes, till the end of Golus. And it was that time that the rabbis made many of the rabbinic safeguards to keep us from assimilating amongst the nations of the world. They prohibit us drinking non-kosher wine and things that were baked and cooked by non-Jews in order to avoid assimilation. Those were done during those 420 years. And the tefillah, right, the institutionalized davening was instituted there, and the reading of the Torah. Many things that would be able to keep us alive and afloat in Golus were instituted during those 420 years of Bayis Sheni. So, and therefore, this boost was necessary basically for the weak people. But the people who were strong didn't need the Shabbaton. They didn't need this boost. So that's why they stayed in Bavel. They knew that eventually there's going to be another Churban. Eventually everybody's going to go back into Golus. So there was no purpose to go back except to be strengthened. They didn't need to be strengthened. So they stayed in Bavel. That's what the Rabbi Yonason Apeshit says. And based on this, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky extends it. And he says that's what happened after the Holocaust. After the Holocaust, many Jews, if not most Jews, were on such a low ebb of feeling that God abandoned us, that being a Jew is a terrible thing, and many Jews just hid their Jewishness. They didn't want to be known as Jews because they saw that what happens to Jews world over. So they just forgot about being Jews. They just blended and got lost into society, whether it was in America or in Europe, whatever it may be. And the Rabban Shalom saw that if he doesn't do something, there's not going to be any Jewish people to redeem. So he gave us back the State of Israel as a boost, specifically to the weak people. The strong people didn't need that boost. They'll be around anyway. So the major impact of the State of Israel was on the people who are estranged from Judaism, the secular Jews. They're the ones who now look at the State of Israel. This was true until the Yom Kippur War. After the Yom Kippur War, things changed drastically. But until the Yom Kippur War, Israel was a rallying point for irreligious Jews who found their Jewish identity in the State of Israel. We are Israelis, right? Even if you live in America, but I give money to the State of Israel. I buy Israeli bonds. I sing Hatikvah. I wave the Israeli flag. It gave people Jewish identity. And therefore, the whole idea of the state was necessary for the weak people who would not be around till Mashiach comes if there wasn't something to give them another Shabbaton. This Shabbaton was the State of Israel. That is Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, which in fact, it was only supposed to be 3 days in the desert, had Paro agreed, but since he didn't agree, God had to go for plan B and take us out 190 years early. Those are the answers that I'm familiar with. Now I'll tell you what I think. Yeah.
Does that mean that the State of Israel will be destroyed before the...
It doesn't have to be destroyed. It just will be transformed into what Eretz Israel is supposed to be. There'll be a Melech HaMashiach who will take the place of a prime minister and government, and it doesn't have to be destroyed. It can just have a metamorphosis of going from the larva that it is now, right, to a nice butterfly. Yeah.
What happened after the Yom Kippur War?
After the Yom Kippur War, I don't know. But that surely what Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said does not apply after that. After the Yom Kippur War, Israel is not only not a place, a rallying point for secular Jews to be proud of Judaism, but it is a horse to beat for people who are anti themselves, self-hating Jews, who use Israel as a place to beat themselves over how unfair Israel is, right, to the Palestinians or whatever, and how much they're disgraced to be Jews, to be aligned with Israel. It's mamish the opposite. Why it's like that, I don't know. And let me tell you what I think. According to all these reasons, it never really happened that they went 3 days in the desert and sacrificed. It was all either a trick, it was a ploy to enable Paro to agree eventually to the real thing, or it was plan A, but plan A never happened, and plan B happened. I'm going to tell you what I think. Not only is this what they wanted, this is exactly what happened. It's not a trick. It's not plan A. It is the description of Geulas Mitzrayim. Perfectly. Now let me explain how that is. In order to understand this, you have to understand what redemption is, what it means to be free, what Geula is. Okay? Because freedom is a very elusive kind of thing. Most people think freedom means hefkeris, do whatever you want. But that's not real freedom. Because Chazal say, Ein lecha ben chorin, ela misha osik batorah. Real freedom is being immersed totally in Torah. Not just learning Torah. Not just observing Torah. Osik batorah. Totally immersed, involved in Torah. That is freedom. Now, I understand that being totally immersed and involved in Torah is very, very positive. But that's freedom? I would say that a person who is not committed to Torah is a lot freer than I am. Right? I can't eat everything I want, and there's a lot of things I would love to eat if I could. Right? All those stuff look really good. The truth is that they all look really good until they become kosher, and then you can taste it, and then you say, this is what I wanted. Right? Usually the Yetzer Hara is more imagination than anything else. And as long as it's Osir, it looks really, really inviting, and once it becomes mutter, it's not so inviting anymore. But in any case, but there are a lot of things I would like to eat and I can't. A lot of things I like to do and I can't. And that's freedom. I'm not free. Okay, I'm a slave. Right? I'm a slave to the Rabbanu Shel Olam, but I'm a slave. The guy who can eat whenever he wants, work whenever he wants, do whatever he wants, go wherever he wants, he's free. I'm not free. So how in the world can Chazal say, Ein lecha ben chorin al mishos betorah? Torah is everything, but it's not freedom. Why is that freedom? So some say the idea is like a map. You can be free to do anything you want, but if you don't have any direction, then your freedom is worthless. Okay? So the Torah gives you direction to direct your freedom. I can go anywhere I want, but if I don't follow a map, I'm not going to get to where I want to go. That's very nice, but I'm still not free. I've chosen to limit my freedom to my goal. Now I need a map to get to my goal, but that's not freedom to do anything I want. So, still doesn't really answer the question. Yeah?
The Yetzer Hara is what traps a person. So, if you're totally immersed in Torah, you're totally limited to the Yetzer Hara, and therefore you're able to function in a dynamic without that entrapment of the Yetzer Hara.
Okay, excellent. But I get paid to give this shiur, so I'm going to have to say it.
Okay, fine.
But you're right. But I'm going to take what you said in one sentence and say it in about 1,000 sentences.
Of course.
That's what a rabbi is. The idea is the following. Chazal say that deep down inside, every Jew wants to do what's right. Ritzoneinu la'asos ritzonecha. We want to do your will, Rabbanu Shel Olam. There's a part of the neshama that can never be blemished. Never be corrupted. It remains pure and holy always, and it's always screaming it wants to do God's will. So the Gemara says, so what, why don't we, if we have that neshama screaming to do God's will, why don't we do it? Mama Akev, what prevents us? Soor Shebeisa, the Yetzer Hara superimposes other wills that we think that's what we want to do. But the truth is, deep down, we know that we'd rather do something else. Our neshamas know what's good for us and for it, which is us. And shibud malchios, and subjugation to the nations of the world. Now, simple meaning is that sometimes we'd love to do God's will, but we're prevented by goyim who won't let us. But there's a deeper idea. Subjugation comes in two varieties: physical subjugation and cultural subjugation. There's a normal Yetzer Hara that exists for various things. Foods, sexual pleasures, money. Those are natural, people are born with a natural tendency and drive for these things, for good reasons. All of those things are great things. It's good to have an appetite for food, otherwise you'd starve to death. It's good to have a sexual appetite, otherwise you'd never get married and have children. It's good to have a desire to make money or whatever, else you'd have no drive, right? You would never accomplish anything. But those Yetzer Haras, if they are not guided, then they're going to lead you to bad. That's why they're called the Yetzer Hara. They're natural drives. That's why it says you should serve God with the Yetzer Hara, meaning use these drives and direct them for the good things. If you don't direct them, then they're inevitably going to go for the bad. But there are certain things that people are not born with a drive to do. Those are Shibud Malchios. Those are externally induced desires. Example. Nobody is born with a desire to spend $200 on faded, torn blue jeans. Okay? No one's born and, you know, if he could speak, would say, hey, wear the blue jeans. I got $200 here. Let's go. I'd like to... Right. There's no innate desire to spend $200 on something that you can get for free at the Salvation Army. Right? So why in the world are there people that spend $200 on faded, torn blue jeans? The answer is, it's not a Yetzer Hara. It's Shibud Malchios. It's being culturally subjugated to the nations of the world. And this is a fad. And if the world said, bleached, faded blue jeans cost $200 because they have a label that says Levi's or some other name on it, right, then you buy it. That is not a Yetzer Hara. That's Shibud Malchios. So those are the kinds of things that drive a person from doing what he really wants to do. Now, this is not just a nice hashkafic idea. It has halachic ramifications, says the Rambam, based on the Gemara in Bava Basra. The Gemara says that the case is by a divorce. Okay? In order for a divorce to be effective, the husband has to give the get willingly. If he's forced to give the get against his will, it's not a get. He can give it to the wife, and she gets it, and she, no pun intended, and she receives it, and she, what's it called? She's married. She's still married. It's not a get. It's like he gave her a comic book. He didn't give her a get. It has, one of the 10 conditions of a kosher get is the husband must give it with his total free volition, free will, no forcing. However, the Gemara says there is such a thing as forcing a man to give a get till he says he wants to give it, and that's okay. Kofin oslach yomarotzani. An example. A Kohen marries a divorcee. The marriage is effective, but it's prohibited. Certain marriages, if they're prohibited, aren't effective. A man marries his daughter, gives her a ring, hariat mekudeshesli. There's no marriage. She can go marry anybody she wants. You can't marry your daughter. The kedushin is not effective. But a Kohen can marry a divorcee, but he's not allowed. So now he is in a prohibited marriage, but she's a married woman. She needs a get. So we invite Mr. Cohen into Beis Din. And we say, Mr. Cohen, we understand that you married a divorcee. He says, that's right. He said, you want to call me and give me a mazel tov? No, we don't want to give you a mazel tov. We would like you to divorce her because it's prohibited. So the man says, that's absurd. I love my wife, and I don't really care if the Torah prohibited me from marrying a divorcee. I'll renounce my kahuna, but I am not divorcing my wife. I say, are you sure that you're not going to change your mind? He said, I'm 100% sure. It's okay, grab him. So in the time when Beis Din had the power, they grabbed him. Tie him to the post over there. They tie him to the post, and out comes the guy with the whip. And the Rosh Beis Din says to the man, Mr. Cohen, are you sure that you don't want to divorce your wife? He says, yeah, I'm 100% sure. He says, well, we guess have no real other choice then. We're going to have to give you a little bit of an incentive to divorce your wife. So you start beating him. They beat him a few times, and he's screaming. And they say, Mr. Cohen, maybe you changed your mind. You'd like to divorce your wife. He says, nothing doing. It's okay, beat him more. They beat him, his mama's a bloody pulp lying on the floor. They go over to him, whisper in his ear, Mr. Cohen, maybe you changed your mind. He says, you know what? I think I come around. I think I'd like to divorce my wife. Great! They call in a sofer, she tells him write the get, he writes the get. They call in witnesses, he tells them to sign, they sign. He hands over the get to his wife, right? Barely able to move on the floor. And we say, mazel tov, she's divorced, and what's it called? Finished. Why? Because he said, I want. We forced him till he said, I want. Who are we fooling? This guy doesn't want to give us a get to his wife. He wants you to stop beating him. But he has no desire to divorce his wife. And yet we say it's okay, she could get married. Who are we fooling, says the Rambam. Says the Rambam, no. When that man came into Beis Din, he wanted to divorce his wife. He didn't know it. Deep down, his neshama was screaming, help me, divorce this woman. I'm a Kohen. But the Yetzer Hara put other, superimposed other wills that muffled that sound. Didn't change it. It's still there, but it's superimposed with other desires that muffle it. So we're not changing his will. We're letting his will come to the surface by beating away all the impediments, all the deterrents. That's not called changing a person's mind. That's called letting him express his desire outward. Until it comes outward, it's not his desire. It's only an inside potential desire. But we're letting that potential desire become actual by beating away all of the superimposed desires that the person had. And it works halachically. That means it's emeth. It's a fact. So everybody deep down inside would like to do Ratzon Hashem. What prevents him? The Yetzer Hara. The Shibud Malchios. We're enslaved. You know what it's like? Since I don't smoke, I will use this as an example because it doesn't hurt me. And if I used other examples, it may apply to me, so I wouldn't like the example. So if you smoke, you'll forgive me. Person who smokes, right? No intelligent person in this world today can possibly want to smoke, right? He may have a desire to smoke because he got in the habit of it, right? He may be addicted to it. But if he would think about it intelligently, you'd ask him, do you want to smoke? Right? You know that smoking is, what's it called, is dangerous. It could cause who knows how many different kinds of diseases. It costs so much money. It makes your fingers yellow, your teeth yellow. It makes your breath stink, right? Do you really want to do this? I'm sure any sane person would say, no, I don't want to do it. Intellectually, no. I can't control myself. When I see that cigarette, when I have that desire to smoke, it's just an addiction. I can't control myself. I'd love to stop. You know what that means? That guy's a slave. That means, basically, he's saying, I don't really want to smoke, but when that little cigarette pulls off his whip and says, smoke me, you smoke because the cigarette forces you. So you're a slave to a cigarette. And the same applies to all the other Yetzer Haras that we have. If you thought about it intellectually, you wouldn't want to do it. But you're addicted. You can't control yourself. So you're a slave. Freedom is being able to do what you really want to do. That's real freedom. And therefore, Ein lecha ben chorin el misha osik b'Torah. Only somebody totally immersed in Torah. Barasi Yetzer Hara, Barasi Torah Tavlin. The Torah neutralizes the Yetzer Hara. It takes away the Shibud Malchios. It makes you free. Free to do what you really want to do. That's real freedom. Because any other freedom is only perceived. That you're doing what you think you want to do, but deep down you know that's not what's good for you. What's good for you eternally is to do Ratzon Hashem. So only somebody who's free of any of the shackles from within or from without that impede him from doing Ratzon Hashem is not a free person. He's a slave. Only free person is person who's Osik B'Torah. That's what you said in one sentence. Memela like this. The concept of Geula, okay, and therefore it explains a very interesting point of the Seder. What is the food that represents redemption? We are redeemed in haste, and therefore we eat this food. What is it? Matzah. Matzah is the bread of freedom. It is the symbol of freedom. We get out of Egypt in haste. We didn't have time for our bread to leaven, and we're eating matzah as a symbol of freedom. In the beginning of the Seder, we pick up the symbol of slavery. This is the bread of affliction which our forefathers ate in Egypt. What is that? Matzah. Why is matzah a symbol of slavery? Because that is the bread that we ate in Mitzrayim for 210 years. It says, this is the bread of affliction our forefathers ate in Egypt. They didn't eat in Egypt. They ate it when they left Egypt. Says the Ibn Ezra, no. You know what they ate in Egypt for 210 years? Matzah. You know why? Because it's a very economical food. The Ibn Ezra says, in my time in Spain, that's what they fed prisoners, matzah. Why? It only has bread, flour and water. No other additives. It's made very quickly, so there's no labor factor. And it doesn't digest very quickly, so it lays in your stomach. You don't want to eat a lot of it. You're satisfied with a little bit. Okay, I think the matzah I ate last Pesach or two Pesach ago is still in my stomach. So Therefore, it's a very economical food. Something has changed today, and the reason it's called lechem oni today is because that's what you are after you buy it. But lemaisa, it used to be an economical food, right? If you take away all the hashgachas, it's still what's it called, a very economical food. It should be cheap. So that's what they fed slaves, economical food. So it's very strange that the Torah would use the symbol of slavery to be the symbol of freedom. If I were asked to design a Seder, I would do it differently. I would start with matzah. This is a symbol of slavery. This is what we eat in the beginning of the Seder. But for dessert, you know what I would have? Strawberry shortcake, 7-layer cake. Right, now that's freedom, right? So you start with the matzah and you end with 7-layer cake, and that makes sense. But you start with the matzah and you end with the matzah? The answer is, we didn't change from being slaves from the beginning of the Seder to the end of the Seder. We started out slaves, we ended up slaves. The difference is not if we're slaves or not. The question is who we're slaves to. And it says that in the Hallel. Halleluka, hallelu, avdei Hashem. We are God's slaves. And the Gemara says it. Meikara avdei de paro. Originally we were paro slaves. V'hashta avdei de karish baruch. Now we're God's slaves. And in fact, the Shalom HaKadosh says that's why we're given Eretz Yisrael. Because Eretz Yisrael originally was given to Canaan, who is the proverbial slave. It's a land that's conducive for slaves. Either physical slaves like Canaan, or spiritual slaves like us. Spiritually slaves to God. We are slaves. And in fact, the Shalom says that's why we were in Mitzrayim for 210 years. To learn how to be slaves. To get some preparation for being God's slaves. Slaves we're going to be no matter what. The question is, being a slave to Paro is a real slave, and being a slave to God is being ultimately free. That's the difference. We didn't stop being slaves. We're still eating slave food. The only difference is who the master is. That's the difference. We do not redeem ourselves. God redeems us. This concept that the Jewish people redeem themselves is not true. God redeems us. So what do? What's our part in the redemption? We have to be worthy of redemption. So therefore, before we went out of Mitzrayim, we had to be worthy. We had to have a mitzvah called Pesach, and the mitzvah of what's it called, of matzah and maror. And those mitzvahs made us worthy of being redeemed. But we sat in the house the whole night. We didn't do anything for our redemption. God redeemed us. When the time came to, we were passive. God was the active party in redemption. Redemption is Goel Yisrael, Goel Yisrael. God is the Redeemer. We don't redeem ourselves. But what do? We have to be fit for redemption. Therefore, the Rabban Hashem said like this. He told Moshe, I want to redeem you completely and take you to Eretz Yisrael. But you're going to have to deserve it. So therefore, we're going to have a little trial time called 3 days in the desert to sacrifice to God. And God did not tell Moshe Rabbeinu what that sacrifice was. How many sacrifices? What sacrifices? Moshe tells Paro, we're going to have to take all our cattle with us because God told us we have to sacrifice and he didn't tell us what. We may need all our cattle. He didn't tell us what kind of sacrifices. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know what God meant 3 days in the desert and sacrifice. It was left totally without any explanation. So God said, look, I want the people to go out 3 days in the desert and sacrifice, and that will be the test, whether you're fit to be redeemed. I'm going to take you out. You don't have to go to Paro and ask him permission for me to do what I want to do. I don't need Paro's permission to run the world. So don't even mention to him that I plan to take you out for good. That's my business, not Paro's business at all. But you're his slaves. And in order for me to take you out for good, you're going to have to first prove to me that you are fit for redemption. So I want a trial period of 3 days in the desert and sacrifice. You're Paro's slaves. It's only proper to ask him permission. So ask Paro permission for your part, not for my part. My part, you don't have to ask him anything. Your part is 3 days in the desert and sacrifice. So go to Paro and ask him for permission to go 3 days in the desert and sacrifice. That's all. If after those 3 days in the desert and sacrifice, you deserve it, I'll take you out for good and I don't have to even tell Paro. It's not his business. That's my business. I run the world. Paro's my servant. I don't have to tell my servant what I'm doing with his servants. So all they really wanted to do was go 3 days in the desert. That was their part, and that's what they needed to ask Paro. Okay, so when did this ever happen? When did they go 3 days in the desert and sacrifice? So let me tell you, it's exactly what happened. When did they leave Mitzrayim? On Thursday. They traveled Thursday, Friday, and half a day Shabbos. First Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. And at that point, God said, tell the Jewish people to turn around and go back towards Egypt. And he didn't tell them why. They thought they're going back. That's it. They thought, they asked for 3 days, and thought, they're going back. Now, God was testing them. You think that you are now having to sacrifice the most precious thing in life that you have, which is what? Your freedom. If you can sacrifice your freedom because I told you to go back, then you understand what freedom is. Freedom is to do what I want you to do. It's not being free outside the environs of Egypt. If you can't make that sacrifice, if you say, Rabbanu Shalom, ask us for anything. You want our shoes, you want our clothes, you want all our money, we're willing to give you anything. We're not giving up our freedom. Then you don't understand what freedom is. You don't deserve to be free. Then, Tak, you have to go back. So the Rabbanu Shalom took them out 3 days in the desert, and then he demanded a sacrifice. But not an animal sacrifice. That's what they thought. They had to sacrifice the most precious thing that they had at that moment was their freedom. If they could do it and willingly go back and listen to the Rabbanu Shalom, then they understood what freedom was. Then you deserve to be redeemed. And then God took us out. And that's exactly what happened. If we wouldn't have done that, we'd say, Rabbanu Shalom, ask us for anything, not that. Then we would have been back in Egypt. So that's exactly what happened. We asked for 3 days in the desert to sacrifice, not knowing what the sacrifice was going to be. We asked for that because that was our part in the redemption. And we had to ask Paro permission to do what we had to do. But we didn't have to ask permission for God's part. That's the full redemption that would eventually come after that if we proved ourselves worthy. So God didn't even mention to Paro what his part was. He didn't have to. But we had to mention what our part was. Our part was a 3-day stint in the desert as a trial balloon to see if we were fit to be what's it called, to be redeemed. So what happened and what was Paro was asked wasn't subterfuge, wasn't a trick, it wasn't part, it wasn't plan A, it was exactly what was going to be. 3 days in the desert, sacrifice, from that point on God would take over, and that he didn't have to tell Paro or ask his permission, and that I think is what's going on in the 3 days in the desert.